The podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than 500,000 Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash. Today, it is Wednesday, May 16th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit norml.org to get involved today. We have a great Wednesday show for you here today, a brand new segment with Dr. Mitch Earlywine highlighting some summer reading for us today. We'll also speak with Ray Warren, the state policy coordinator at the Marijuana Policy Project, about different legislative initiatives happening in state houses around the country. Tomorrow on the program, we'll speak with Paul Armentano, Normal Senior Policy Analyst. We'll speak again with Ray Warren and also Gabriel Saya of the Drug Policy Alliance for a roundup of legislative efforts on marijuana and medical marijuana around the country. Make sure to tune in every day here to Normal's Daily Audio Stash for the most up-to-date information regarding marijuana law reform. You can always visit our website for links and more information at normalaudiostash.com. Let's get right into our stash today with our Wednesday Cannabis Science segment with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Here on the Audio Stash, we have our Cannabis Science segment with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Mitch is professor of psychology at the State University of New York and author of the book, Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. He's also editor of the new book, Pot Politics. We have links to the books on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Mitch, welcome back to the show today.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Great to speak with you as always, Mitch. Now, I know you're rounding up the school year there at SUNY, and all good college professors recommend some summer reading. And you sent by a list of some books that those of us who are interested in marijuana reform would find good for summertime page-turners. So let's start off at the top here with a book by Richard Bonney and Charles Whitebread. The title is The Marijuana Conviction, A History of Marijuana Prohibition in the United States. It's published by the Lynn Smith Center for Public Policy. So, Mitch, tell us how you got familiar with this book and why you think it's a good read.
Well, Charles Whitebread was actually on the faculty at USC in the law school when I was at Southern Cal, and I happened to look it up when I was doing research for Understanding Marijuana. And The Marijuana Conviction is just a splendid and really detailed and thoughtful summary of the history of marijuana laws here in the United States. And as soon as you walk through just the, you know, states that passed the first anti-cannabis laws, you realize this has nothing to do with protecting children or worries about marijuana and its safety, it's very much about controlling Mexican immigrants. So you see that, you know, Texas, a lot of southern states were the ones that seemed to be the ones that first made these anti-marijuana laws. And Bonnie and Whitebread are both really straightforward in just sticking to the facts and supporting their argument. And once you get Charles Whitebread to have a glass of wine with you, you discover he's more than willing to say that this is a war on culture. This is about discriminating against people and has very little to do with the psychoactive properties of any plants. And it's just intriguingly elegant and wonderful and a real piece of Americana. And so a lot of folks who say, oh, I'm really not interested in history, but I do love the green, discover that they are interested in history once they sit down with a book like this.
And what sets this book, The Marijuana Conviction, apart from other cannabis prohibition history books like Jack Herer's famous The Emperor Wears No Clothes?
I love Jack's book, and the photos and the, you know, illustrations are truly splendid. But this is much more focused on legal cases. These guys are both in political science in one way or another, and it's much more serious piece of scholarship. So you won't have, you know, drawings of monkeys taking hits through masks the way you do in Jack's book, and it's not the same coffee table appeal as you have in The Emperor's New Clothes. But when you're done, you realize you've become a scholar of not only marijuana but American history, and you've got new insights into not only cannabis prohibition, but also alcohol prohibition and some of the prohibitions we have against certain guns. And you'll find yourself talking with your libertarian friends in a new way. And so it's very curious how it alters your perception of the whole way government works, not just how you feel about hemp or psychoactive cannabis.
And Mitch, also on your book list is a piece of pure prohibitionist propaganda. This book I'm not really familiar with. I haven't seen it before. And we're not recommending it for a read per se, but more a book to leave on the shelf. The title is The Truth About Pot, 10 Recovering Marijuana Users Share Their Stories. Now, right away, anyone familiar with the science of marijuana should be skeptical from the subtitle there, but tell us a bit about this book.
As it turns out, I write a lot of reviews for the American Psychological Association, and I'm always reluctant to give bad book reviews, but I feel like this one is a real disaster. And when you go through each of these individual cases, you find that each of these people blames pot for all kinds of personal problems in a way that is just dumbfounding. So I was so distressed at the very first case study, where this person clearly had a whole lot of difficulties long before ever going anywhere near cannabis. And then suddenly cannabis takes the blame for all kinds of hard drug use, all kinds of ill-advised sexual encounters, all kinds of traumatic experiences interpersonally that, you know, clearly have nothing to do with cannabis and everything to do with a whole lot of bad personal decisions. And I feel like this is the argument we often get from the treatment community, and it's impossible to disprove. So when I'm up against these people and they say, pot made me do this and pot made me do that, and I can only say, look, in the laboratory we give people pot and they don't do that, you know, it's impossible to disprove this kind of work. If you want to hear a nice story about how someone has, you know, overcome the way cannabis has worked for them, check out Roger Rothman's chapter in Pot Politics, where he's very candid about his own troubled use of the drug and how he decided he no longer wanted to use it anymore. And it's much more reasonable than some of these really alarmist, melodramatic tales that unfortunately appear in this book.
Now, Mitch, we know that all the science tells us out of regular cannabis consumers, only about 10% show any signs of what is traditionally classed as dependence. So for the very, very, very few amount of people out there that show any signs of dependence to cannabis, what would be a more practical solution for these individuals rather than the blame-all approach of this book?
There is a Marijuana Anonymous group, but the meetings aren't held in every city the way the other 12-step groups are. Folks who are, you know, problem marijuana users tell me they go to the NA meetings sometimes and are kind of ridiculed and even, you know, chastised out of there, and I feel like that's completely unfair as well. I have family members who are in 12-step groups, but my friend Stanton Peel has been extremely critical of this, particularly the idea that it's the only way to battle troubles. And I got to say that, you know, most of our data on how folks handle problem marijuana use just don't address any of these 12-step issues. It's much more focused on looking at the pros and cons of your own use and making conscious decisions to decrease or stay away because you've decided that it's worth it to you. And the idea that there's a market for this, if it's going to be this, you know, overstated and confusing, makes me sad and makes me really want to reach out even more to the treatment community and say, I understand if you're struggling, but let's be honest about what are the real sources of your troubles, and is it all this plant, or is it actually decisions you've made on your own?
All right, now let's get back to some books that contain some good information out here, Mitch. Next on the list is a book by Douglas Husak. The title is Legalize This, The Case for Decriminalizing Drugs. Now, the book looks at drug policy overall. Tell us a bit about it.
Doug Husak is, I think, just a brilliant philosopher and also an attorney. He has a chapter in Pot Politics on a comparable topic, and all he does is walk through the idea that we really need to have a system where punishments fit the crime. And as he goes through, you know, what a neat rationale it is to say you're not going to be punished more than you deserve for any crime, he then puts the sort of drug war on the other foot and says not why should such and such be legalized, but why is possession of anything illegal? And people jump up and down and say, oh, because it leads to this or it leads to that, it leads to violence, it leads to drug problems. Well, all those things have their own consequences built in. It seems unfair to, you know, make some possession of something illegal just because we're afraid it might lead to something else that's already illegal anyway. And he points out that there are, you know, literally thousands and thousands of laws on the books. Do we really need to add more in some strange hope of sort of drawing a wall around the law in an effort to decrease crime, when in fact all we end up doing is wasting a lot of law enforcement time and creating disrespect for the law because it's essentially immoral to create punishments that are out of whack with the severity of the crime?
Also, Doug Husak puts forward the notion that people who enjoy recreational substances such as marijuana and consume responsibly are in fact normal, not to make a pun there, but those who consume recreationally in a responsible manner are in fact better off in many ways overall than those who are abusing substances, or even on the other extreme, folks who are stone cold sober all the time.
There are, you know, a lot of controversies around that data with certain drugs, and, you know, the argument with heroin chippers or folks who use methamphetamine, I think, might be relatively weak, but certainly for cannabis users, that's the case. And folks might remember Jacob Sullum's book, Saying Yes, which also, you know, has some really extensive interviews with folks who, you know, beg to be anonymous but are using drugs intermittently in a very responsible way with absolutely no negative consequences, and sure enough, flourishing and having a wonderful life. And when I bring this up to people, they often say, you know, any little problem that anybody has, they attribute it to drugs. And it's like, if you're going to be a recreational drug user, you have to have a life that's absolutely perfect in their eyes. And I think that's such an unfair standard. If I turned that same thing on, say, organized religion, you know, if I said, oh, if organized religion is worthwhile, then you have to absolutely have a perfect life, or you're wasting these hours in church every week or something like that, you know, people would be up in arms, when in fact the amount of time people, you know, spend under the influence of a drug versus the amount of time they spend watching TV is, you know, intriguingly comparable, as both Jacob Sullum and Doug Husak have pointed out.
And rounding out our summer reading here today is a book by two dynamic individuals who have both appeared here on the Audio Stash, Steve Cubby and Ed Rosenthal. Their book is Why Marijuana Should Be Legal. And I understand there is now an updated version out there.
Folks may remember an earlier edition of this book, but the new one is a delightful set of editions, as well as all the same familiar arguments. What I find about this one is it's just incredibly accessible. So you don't have every single reference and every single journal article explaining exactly why they think what they think, but you get the arguments loud and clear, broken down in really nice McNugget-sized essays, if you will. And, you know, particularly given the struggles that Ed is going through right now, which seems to be the ultimate in time-wasting and effort-wasting, you know, law enforcement strategies, I feel like it's important for us all to, you know, offer him our support, whether it's buying the book or going to his website or doing anything we can to just make sure that marijuana is not only legal, but that somebody like Ed, who's really trying to help the sick, doesn't end up on the wrong side of the law.
You know, also, one of the coolest aspects of this book, Why Marijuana Should Be Legal, are the Doonesbury cartoon strips and art. And often at the normal conferences, there is an original Doonesbury strip for silent auction as a fundraiser, and Trudeau's been a great friend of normal and marijuana reform over the years.
Well, and Trudeau really understands the dangers of some of the legal drugs, as well as the complete absence of troubles associated with cannabis, is, writing scripts where people are medical cannabis users and going through, the illicit market in ways that seem, you know, comical if it doesn't make you, you know, actually break down and cry. And then you suddenly realize, wow, he's got a really persuasive message in a format that not a lot of folks can use. And so I'm just so grateful to him for letting Ed use, you know, the strips there in the book, and just being a friend to our movement from, you know, really way, way long time ago.
Well, Mitch, we're going to recap here real quick. The Marijuana Conviction, a great book about the history, the legal history of marijuana prohibition here in the United States by Richard Bonney and Charles Whitebread. We'll have links to all these books on our website at normalaudiostash.com. One to leave on the shelf, though, is The Truth About Pot, 10 Recovering Marijuana Users Share Their Stories. And then, of course, was Douglas Hussek's book, Legalize This, The Case for Decriminalizing Drugs. And also, as you pointed out, Doug has a chapter in your book, Pot Politics. And finally here today, Why Marijuana Should Be Legal by Steve Cubby and Ed Rosenthal. Just a great book. We'll have links to the books that contain the good information on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. And Mitch, this has been a great set of books to highlight for summer reading here.
Well, let me add that whenever you take a book like this to the beach, you're bound to have a really interesting conversation.
Indeed. Bring Why Marijuana Should Be Legal to the Sunset Watch on Key West or on the sun deck of a cruise this summer and watch the conversation fly. Mitch, many thanks again for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure, Chris.
Thank you again, Mitch. Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at the State University of New York. He's author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. He's editor of the new book Pot Politics. We have links to the books on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Mitch joins us each Wednesday here on the program.
What's up, guys? This is Miss High Times 2007, and you're chilling with us here at the Normal Podcast.
Stay tuned. Next up today, we're going to speak with Ray Warren of the Marijuana Policy Project. On the Audio Stash, we're highlighting different state legislative reform efforts for marijuana and medical marijuana happening around the country. Yesterday, we spoke with Gabriel Saya of the Drug Policy Alliance about Connecticut. Tomorrow, we'll hear from Normal's senior policy analyst Paul Armentano with updates on Tennessee and other states, and we'll speak again with Gabriel at the Drug Policy Alliance about the reform of the Rockefeller drug laws in New York State. Today on the program, we're going to speak with Ray Warren. Ray is the State Policies Director for the Marijuana Policy Project. Ray, welcome to the Audio Stash today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's wonderful to speak with you today, Ray, during this extremely busy legislative reform season. Let's start out with MPP's efforts in Vermont. After speaking with Gabriel at the Drug Policy Alliance yesterday, it really seems like New England is becoming a hotspot of reform.
Yes, New England is becoming the sort of the center of, especially on medical marijuana, on medical marijuana reform. Vermont is a medical marijuana state, but at the moment the law is very restrictive on conditions, very restricted on amount of medicine that can be grown or possessed at any one time. This year we have quarterbacked and assisted in passing a reform bill in Vermont that's going to expand the number of plants that patients can possess and also expand the conditions that are covered. For example, chronic and debilitating pain, which right now is not covered, would be covered. I'm very excited that we've passed both houses of the Vermont legislature, and this is on the desk of Governor Douglas as we speak today. Hopefully in the next few days he'll either sign it or allow it to go into effect without his signature as he did last time.
And you mentioned chronic pain. We know that there is strong science to show that marijuana is effective for a variety of conditions that cause chronic pain and for the pain itself. But that phrase, chronic pain, is that something that seems too broad to lawmakers?
That does come up in a lot of states, and it is a bit of an issue. But it's very important that the laws not be so tightly drawn that people who would benefit and could benefit from the medical use of marijuana are not able to because they don't fit technically into a certain condition. That is one of the tougher calls sometimes, and a lot of times what we end up doing is what happened in Vermont is that we pass a fairly restrictive law, and once the law goes into effect, the legislature sees that no bad consequences come from allowing people access to this kind of product. Then we're able to go back and do what we're doing in Vermont and expand it a little bit. It's important to understand, though, that under none of the medical marijuana laws are patients allowed to self-diagnose. So you really do need to have a physician say this condition exists, and I think that's an important safeguard that we have to point out to legislatures.
And, Ray, we've seen from these reform bills, especially when it comes to medical marijuana in New England, these bills really get broad bipartisan support. The issue really hasn't had the party line to it in many places.
Fortunately, in almost all of the states we work in, it is a bipartisan issue. Now, certainly, in most cases, one party is a little more supportive than the other party, but no medical marijuana law has been enacted by a legislature, at least, in recent past without bipartisan support, not only in Vermont, but in Rhode Island recently. We have a bill there, which in one chamber, I believe it was the House, we received a majority of the Republicans. In the other chamber, there was a one-vote difference, but there was still substantial Republican support for the medical marijuana bill. So you are exactly right. In every state, there are supporters on both sides of the issue. And what I find is typically the most important factor is not so much ideology as personal knowledge. If somebody knows a cancer patient or an MS patient or an HIV patient, that really has a lot more impact on their openness to the idea than their specific party ideology.
When we talk about these state-elected officials compared to their national counterparts in Congress, does that direct interaction with patients and seriously ill individuals, does that have more of an impact on these state-level officials, do you think?
Well, they absolutely do, and state legislatures, especially in many of the smaller states, are really open to sort of the personal experience. I think having good patient testimony at formal hearings is terribly important. Having patients make an appointment and meet with their legislature is very important. Medical marijuana is one of those issues that there's an abstract gut reaction, pro or con, but if you can put a face on it and put a real person there, I think it makes all the difference in the world, and we've seen that in state after state. It's a little harder in the bigger states like California and New York, but even there I think it's important, and for all activists, I think we can cite studies, we can cite science, we can cite celebrities, but there's nothing like an actual real person having the courage and the faith to come forward and say, I have this condition, I really need this medicine. I think it moves a lot of legislators.
And when we talk about those big states like New York, Ray, I have to wonder, how much has the internet shrunk those states, with people sending emails and taking action online?
The internet has helped a lot. I mean, the ability to email legislators instantly is I think, important. But what you tend to get with emails is numbers become more important than individual cases. The legislators just receive so many. So my comment and my feedback to activists who want to support good reform legislation would be that we really need both. When it comes to emails, even though legislators receive a lot, at the end of the day, what they do is they sort of do a count and say, well, how much interest is there in this issue? How many pro emails did I receive? How many con emails? So it's very important to send that email, even though it may seem like, well, I'm one of 200. Yes, but you're skewing what amounts to an election that day on the issue. On the other hand, I want to caution people that this personal touch is important, and the using an email and the internet does not replace being able to call up your legislator. In most states, a legislator will meet with a constituent from their district. I mean, It's not like Congress, where you may not have a chance to get in to see your congressperson. You really do have a chance to see your state legislator, and I think that personal aspect shouldn't be lost just because we have technology and other ways to reach them. If they see you, if they talk to you, it will have an impact.
Now, a few moments ago, we were discussing the bipartisan support of medical marijuana. One of the places where there is a lot of that cross-party support is New York State, where you're working on a medical marijuana bill. Now, New York is a decrim state already. Marijuana has been decriminalized across the state, although not really in New York City, as we found out. But do you think that that decrim status makes it easier or harder for medical marijuana to pass there?
I don't know that the decrim status makes it that much easier. It certainly doesn't make it harder. I think there's a much less visceral attitude about medical marijuana in New York than, say, in some of the smaller or more southern states. But the fact that penalties for small personal amounts have been reduced or eliminated doesn't really help us on the medical side. One of the problems with we do have strong bipartisan support there, but one of the problems that you have in situations like New York is one chamber is controlled by one party, the Senate in that case being Republican. The Assembly or House side is controlled by the Democrats. And although both sides are very supportive, nobody wants to be first. So there's always this delicate dance of everybody making sure that everybody else is on board and on the same page. And a lot of that's going on in New York, but you are exactly right. The state Senate Republicans have been very supportive. I think that's exciting. I don't think there's a partisan side to medical marijuana. It's or to marijuana reform in general. I think it's a very human issue that really shouldn't divide along those lines.
Also, Ray, let's stay up in New England. Let's talk about New Hampshire. Tell us about what happened there.
Well, New Hampshire was exciting this year. We went in there. The New Hampshire House is actually the third largest legislative body in the world, right behind the British House of Commons and the United States House of Representatives. There are 400 members, and a typical House district in New Hampshire only contains a little over 3,000 persons. So New Hampshire politics is very retail and very much a matter of local politics. We had a vote in the state house. We came up, I believe, 9 votes short in that 400-member house. It was much closer than our opponents thought it would be. It was the first time we really brought the issue to a full 4 vote like that. But we're excited because that was a very small margin. We know there's room for gains in New Hampshire. And under the rules, we can go back next year to the state Senate in New Hampshire, and we intend to do that. And if we get through the Senate, the rules can be suspended in such a way that it could go to the House. So the basic lesson out of New Hampshire was a lot of retail politics. There was a lot of patient contact. There was a lot of coalition building there, a lot of libertarian-type Republicans who helped us there. And more than 20 Republicans voted for the bill in the State House of Representatives. And we came very close, and next year New Hampshire will definitely be a high-priority state for MPP.
And on the whole, Ray, do you find that state elected officials are more sophisticated, more informed on marijuana issues than their federal counterparts?
Well, they definitely have a better, a broader knowledge base than the federal legislators. You see that particularly in a state like California, where the legislature was very supportive. Of course, their medical marijuana is legal in California. And yet you have a large block of the state congressional delegation continuing to vote to allow the federal government basically to invade California and enforce federal law over state law. So there's definitely a dichotomy there. I think the state legislators are closer to the people on this issue and are ahead of the Congress members, who tend to react sort of viscerally and emotionally without really listening to their constituents as much.
And also, too, Ray, with all of this state legislative activity this year, do you think this signals that marijuana reform has really come of age, reached a turning point with this traditional engagement in politics, that it's paying off overall, and that reform in general is going to be happening sooner than later?
I think we're getting close to that, but I also think we have some challenges ahead, and again, I want to have a cautionary note to activists that we not cease to be very active on this because, as you pointed out, New England is becoming fairly solid. Our colleague organization, DPA, is working very hard in Connecticut, and hopefully they'll have some success there this year. But we have medical marijuana now in Rhode Island, Vermont, Maine. We hope to pick up New York later this year. Massachusetts next year will probably be some initiative action using their ballot initiative. So basically, New England's looking good. If we get Minnesota this year, we are going to make a big push in Illinois next year. So the Great Lakes is beginning to look pretty good. But when you combine that with the other medical marijuana states, which are largely in the West Coast, we've sort of picked a lot of the low-hanging fruit, the places where people were very open to the idea. And the next challenge is really going to be to make this mainstream, to be able to go to places like North Carolina and Tennessee and Missouri and Florida and begin to educate folks there. And I think that's going to be a challenge. I think we are getting at a tipping point. Marijuana has been legal for medical purposes for over a decade now. The sky has not fallen, but I think we have some challenges moving from a stage where people are somewhat open to the idea to moving to a stage where there's going to have to be a lot of education.
Very good, Ray. Well, I want to thank you again for taking time to speak with us today, and I look forward to speaking with you again on the legislation happening out there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, and thank you for what you're doing.
Many thanks again, Ray. Ray Warren is the State Policies Coordinator at the Marijuana Policy Project. Tomorrow on the Audio Stash, we'll hear a bit more from Ray and also Gabriel Saya of the Drug Policy Alliance and Paul Armentano, Normal Senior Policy Analyst. Stay tuned here to Normal's Daily Audio Stash for the most up-to-date information about marijuana law reform. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow.
Of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana, and over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Stropp, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.